Okay, now we're to our final speaker of the day, David Anderson. He joined the Coalition for Evidence-Based Policy in 2004 and currently serves as its vice president. Over the past decade, the Coalition has played a leadership role in expanding the use of evidence-based policymaking. He's worked closely with top officials in the Obama and the Bush administration, as well as Congress, to advance evidence-based reforms in diverse policy areas. This includes child welfare, teen pregnancy prevention, K-12 education, and job training. Mr. Anderson played a central role in the development, launch, and operation of the Coalition's Help Desk for the U.S. Office of Management and Budget and the What Works Clearinghouse Help Desk. And he has served as a lead help desk moderator on both. In this role, he's provided personalized assistance to a wide range of help desk users, including leading the Coalition's in-depth review of more than 100 evaluations of federally funded math and science education programs and projects for the Congressionally Established Academic Competitive Council. And in his presentation, he'll talk about a number of these programs that they've reviewed to find out if they really work for the money that we're spending on them. He holds a master's degree in public policy from Duke and a Bachelor of Arts degree from University of Denver. Welcome, David.
All right. Good morning. It is still morning. Okay. So I'm going to be talking a little bit about how to identify evidence-based jobs programs. I know you've heard a lot today about sort of the gap between the skills, the jobs that are out there and the skills of the people that need jobs. And so obviously there's a need for effective job training programs, and I'm going to talk a little bit about how to identify those. I'll start off by talking about the rationale for evidence-based policy and why we believe that evaluation and going for rigorous evidence is an important part of developing a good workforce system. And then I'll close by talking about some of the things that rigorous evaluations have taught us about what works in workforce policy. Just to give you a real brief introduction about who we are, I know Esther just gave a little bit of that. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, and our mission, our whole reason for being, is to increase government effectiveness through the wider use of rigorous evidence about what works. Importantly, we have no affiliations with any programs or program models, and we don't have any financial interest in any of the ideas that we put forward to policymakers. So we can serve as an independent source of expertise on evidence-based policy and evidence-based programs. Most of our money comes from national foundations like MacArthur and William T. Grant. As Esther mentioned, we've worked closely with top federal officials in the executive and branch in Congress to advance a number of key evidence-based reforms, some of which I'll talk about today. And this slide just gives sort of a brief rundown from an independent assessment that was done for one of our funders, but just cites our role in basically increasingly focus on evidence at the federal level. So that's enough about us. So why, what's the point of evidence-based policy? What's the rationale? Well, the problem that evidence-based policy seeks to address is that U.S. social programs often don't produce their desired results. In many cases, federal funding programs are set up basically as faucets. Congress allocates a large amount of funds to be allocated to state and local organizations, sometimes by formula, sometimes through competition, but where rigorous evidence really doesn't play much of a role in what gets funded. The problem with that is that a number of careful studies over the past decade or so have found that this faucet-type approach is really falling short in achieving the goals of these programs. Since 1995, there have been 11 programs that have been evaluated using the gold standard method of randomly assigning individuals to either receive the program services or to a control group that didn't receive the services. And in 10 of those 11 cases, they found small or no effects for the program. So basically that means that the people who were not served by the program were basically doing just as well as those who were. An important caveat that I should make here, though, is that that doesn't mean that all Head Start centers or all Job Corps centers are ineffective. These evaluations look at the federal program as a whole, and the federal program funds many, many grantees. So what's probably happening is that there are some very effective grantees, but they're being swamped by all of the ineffective ones, and that's what's averaged out in these, the lack of effects in these evaluations. Meanwhile, we've made little progress in addressing a number of important U.S. social program problems over the past several decades. The U.S. poverty rate right now stands at 15%, and it actually bottomed out in 1973, and we haven't really seen much progress since then. A similar story in education. U.S. high school graduation rates peaked in the early 1970s at 81%, and they've basically hovered around 75 to 80% ever since then. And reading and math achievement of 17-year-olds. So basically the main goal of our K-12 education system is to get people reading, doing math well. So it's the end product of that system. We've basically seen flat achievement on those measures for about 40 years. Perhaps most startlingly, the average yearly income of the bottom 40% of U.S. households has changed almost not at all since 1973 after you adjust for inflation. So not to overstate the point, we have seen progress in a number of areas. We've seen reductions in teen pregnancy, reductions in violent crime. But on many measures of how well we're doing as a society, including some of the ones on these slides, we haven't been seeing the type of success that I'm sure that we would hope for. So what we believe is that rigorous evidence and rigorous evaluations hold the key to start sparking progress against some of those long-standing problems. And the reason can best be illustrated with a couple of just quick examples. This first example I'll talk about is from the 1980s. The Department of Labor launched a pilot program to subsidize employers who hired disadvantaged workers, like welfare recipients. And the way the program worked was the workers were given a voucher worth several thousand dollars that they could present to a potential employer. And if the employer hired the worker, the employer could cash the voucher. So it was a financial incentive for them to hire these disadvantaged workers. Now, this pilot program was set up as a rigorous, randomized experiment in which some workers were randomly assigned to receive the vouchers and some were assigned to a control group that didn't. And at the end of the study, what the researchers found was that those individuals in the control group, so those who didn't receive the vouchers, were actually 60% more likely to have landed a job than those who had received the vouchers. So the program completely backfired. Anybody have any guesses as to why that might have happened? Well, what's that?
Were the employers
Well, sort of, yeah. The researchers speculated, and this was, I guess, through interviewing the employers, was the employers, there was sort of a stigma attached to these workers. The employer saw them as sort of hopeless cases that needed this government subsidy to get a job, and so they're thinking, what's wrong with this person? No thanks. So the control group actually was much better off. So what rigorous evaluations, one thing that they can do is they can identify those strategies or programs that you think ought to work. They may be backed by expert opinion, or in this case, economic theory. If you pay somebody to do something, they'll do it. But that turn out not to work when you test them in a rigorous evaluation in the real world. And unfortunately, that trend of promising ideas turning out not to work is very common. It's more common, more often than not, in fact, these promising ideas don't pan out. And this is true in medicine, psychology, K-12 education, and as I'll discuss in a little while, workforce policy. But the good news is that rigorous evaluations can and have identified a number of programs that are highly effective in improving important outcomes. This slide just has one example, career academies. Career academies are small learning communities within high poverty high schools. They have a career theme, and they have connections with local employers so that students get actual on-the-job experience while they're going through school. In many ways, there's some similarities to the apprenticeships that Dr. Lerman was talking about a moment ago. And as you can see, in a large randomized controlled trial, this program was found to produce very sizable increases in earnings for the kids who went through these career academies, for the $2,200 per year over a 12-year period. So a big, big effect on an important workforce outcome. Now, in medicine, a drug or device that had this kind of strong evidence would automatically go into widespread use. It's because the FDA requires that you have strong evidence before any drug or device goes onto the market. And when the FDA gives that approval, then You know, things get licensed, that spurs demand, and people start using the device for the drug. In social policy, by contrast, scientific evidence plays very little role in deciding what gets funded. And evidence-based policy seeks to change that. Basically, all of the work that we do as an organization seeks to advance two main types of reforms. The first is to increase funding for rigorous evaluations so we can evaluate more programs and grow the number of research-proven programs that are out there and available for policymakers. And that's a huge issue because probably 95% of what's being done out in the world, not just in workforce policy, but education, criminal justice, probably 95% has never been evaluated, and so we really don't have a great idea what's working and what's not. And the second piece of what we do is we work with policymakers to create strong incentives within funding streams for funding recipients to implement programs that have already been shown effective. And we think that if you can do those two things, we could really start making progress against some of those long-standing problems that I mentioned earlier. And we're happy to say that there has been some movement on that at the federal level, which may have some relevance for you in the room. There have been seven evidence-based initiatives launched over the past few years that incorporate those evidence-based reforms that I talked about. The first two that you see here are related to the workforce system. The Trade Adjustment Assistance Community College and Career Training Grants Program, I don't know why they don't use the acronym, is targeted towards people who have been displaced by trade. And then the Workforce Innovation Fund is targeted towards workers more generally. But what all of these programs have in common is that most of the money that they have is supposed to go to programs that already have some strong evidence of effectiveness. And then most of the rest of the money is supposed to go to promising programs that are willing to undergo a rigorous evaluation, the hope being that those programs will be shown effective and move into the proven category. So I've been using the term evidence a lot here, and so just very briefly I want to talk about what kinds of evidence we believe are needed to increase government effectiveness. And I first want to point out that really a lot of different types of evaluations are needed to increase knowledge about what works. These include implementation studies that look at whether or not a program's even just being implemented well. So if it's a job training program, are people showing up for the training? Are the main elements of the curriculum being taught as intended? They include preliminary comparison group studies, maybe on a small scale, just to get a sense of whether things are working. But a central theme of our work, and this is consistent with the recent National Academies of Sciences recommendation, is that evidence of effectiveness generally can't be considered definitive unless ultimately confirmed in well-conducted randomized trials, even if based on the next strongest designs. So basically, the bottom line message that I'm going to get across here is where you can find results from a randomized controlled trial, those really can be the gold in terms of validity, measuring a valid effect of a program, and I'll talk about that more in a second. So what's special about randomized trials, and why are they considered the gold standard by National Academy of Sciences, Institute of Medicine, and others? It has to do with the process of random assignment. So basically in these studies, you randomly assign a large number of individuals either to get a new program, like a job training program, or to a control group that gets usual services. And that process of random assignment ensures to a high degree of confidence that those two groups are equivalent on all characteristics except for one. Program group got the program, control group didn't. So when you track their outcomes over time, their earnings or their employment, any differences that you see between them can confidently be attributed to the program and not to any other factors. And the important thing to take away about randomized trials is they're uniquely capable of ensuring that you have two groups that are not just equivalent on observable things, like demographics or educational background, but also on unobservable things like motivation, which we all know plays a huge role in people's success, and it's a really hard thing to quantify. But that random assignment process ensures that the two groups are equivalent in motivation as well. And this slide just provides a graphic representation of that. When randomized trials aren't possible, a good second best alternative to look for are observably equivalent comparison group studies. These are sometimes called quasi-experiments or well-matched comparison groups. But the basic thing with these studies is that you have two groups, a program group, people that receive the program, and a control group, a comparison group that doesn't. And the two groups are highly equivalent on observable characteristics, like demographics and education. And most importantly, they need to be equivalent on the pre-program measures of what you're trying to improve. So if you have a job training program, you want to make sure that you have two groups that have highly similar work and earnings histories, since that's going to be the best predictor for their future work and earnings. So to boil it all down to one word, when you're looking at studies or evaluations of programs, somebody comes to you with a program that they say works, what you're looking for is equivalence between two groups, because you want to have two groups, one that gets the program, one that doesn't, and you want to be as confident as possible that everything has been controlled for except for the program group got the program, control group didn't. Now, beneath these more rigorous designs are a number of other evaluation methods that are probably the much more common than the ones I just discussed. Probably 90% of the evaluations that are out there fall into these categories. They include even randomized trials that have limitations, where you have maybe a very small sample, you lose a large portion of your sample, those sorts of things. Comparison group studies where you don't have two equivalent groups, where they didn't do a very careful job of matching people up. And so you have these differences in characteristics that might explain differences in outcomes. They include pre-post studies, which where you measure whether or not people were better or worse off after participating in a program than they were before. And they include outcome metrics, also very common. An example of an outcome metric would be a job training program saying, 85% of our graduates get a job within 6 months. Well, without a control group, you don't know if that's good. Maybe these were highly motivated people. 95% of them would have had jobs if they hadn't wasted their time with an ineffective job training program. So that's why you need to have an equivalent comparison group. And I want to be clear that these designs are very valuable in identifying hypotheses about what works. But we suggest that they really should be tested in a randomized trial, ultimately, before you're really confident that there's an effect. And the reason is that too often promising findings from these less rigorous studies don't pan out when they're subsequently rigorously evaluated. This is true across many fields. In medicine, 50 to 80% of interventions found promising in phase 2 non-randomized studies are found ineffective in phase 3 trials. So a lot of drugs and devices that could have gone onto market don't ultimately make it there because they undergo this more rigorous test and it's found that they don't actually work as well as was thought. In K-12 education, since 2003, the Department of Education has done randomized trials of about 115 interventions. Over 90% of them have been found to have small or no effects. This included even programs that were thought to be highly effective, award-winning software programs, programs where people nominated themselves to be evaluated because they were sure that they were going to have an effect. And a similar pattern occurs in other areas, like workforce policy, as I'll talk about in 1 second. So the bottom line is that you really want to have a rigorous finding of effectiveness before you can absolutely be confident that you've got an effective program. Just before I jump into the workforce programs, just give you one example of how these less rigorous designs can sometimes fall short. What you see here are the results of a randomized trial of the Comprehensive Child Development Program, which was a home visitation program for low-income families, and one of its goals was to increase the self-sufficiency of those families. A lot of times these were single mother-headed families, and so they were trying to get the employment rates up for those mothers. And you can see the results from that trial. The solid line represents the program group, and you can see that they had a big increase in employment over the course of the study. But since this was a randomized trial and there was an equivalent control group, this dashed line shows that control group, so the people who didn't get the program, had the exact same increase in employment. But the important thing to take away from this slide is that if this program had been evaluated in a typical way, just looking at whether or not the mothers were better or worse off after the program, it would have reached the wrong answer. It would have concluded erroneously that the program was highly effective in improving employment when in fact the opposite was true. And they found a similar pattern in welfare seed. If it had been a pre-post study, you would have thought that it really reduced welfare dependence. But as you can see, the control group did basically just as well as the program group. So let me turn now to what rigorous evaluations have taught us about what works in workforce development policy. For this one, I might need to use some notes here a little bit. So I'm going to start off, all of the examples that I'll give you are large randomized trials that have been conducted of programs in workforce development. I'm going to start off with the bad news, which is how I started my presentation too. Always start on a low note. So I'm going to go through a number of programs pretty quickly that were found to have smaller, no positive effects. The summer training and employment program, summer jobs and academic classes for disadvantaged youth, the one-year follow-up had no effect on employment. Unemployment insurance reemployment bonus experiments. This basically provided a cash bonus to unemployment insurance claimants if they got a job quickly. They found some small effects, but they weren't nearly large enough to pay for the program. The Job Training Partnership Act. This is one of those faucet-like programs that I mentioned earlier. It provided a wide range of training for adults and youth and actually found some modest effects for adults on earnings, about $450 to $900 per year increase in earnings for the people who went through the program. But they found no effects for youth, so when you looked across the whole program population, there wasn't much there. The New Chance Demonstration, this is a program that's similar to the Comprehensive Child Development Program I just mentioned, provided home visitation to teenage welfare mothers. And it's probably an example of a program that was trying to do too much all at the same time. They're doing employment training, parenting training, job training, education services, and nothing really panned out. They didn't find effects on any of those outcomes. Center for Employment Training Replication, basically this was providing training for out-of-school youth, and they actually did involve employers in the design of the training, but this one didn't pan out. 4.5-year follow-up, no effects on employment or earnings. Job Corps is another one of these faucet-funded programs, a big federal program, and the initial results from this randomized trial were actually pretty promising. The 4-year follow-up is looking pretty good. There were sizable earnings effects, and the researchers speculated that if those earnings effects continued, the program would more than pay for itself. In fact, they said that the benefits would outweigh the cost by about $17,000. Unfortunately, when they did a 7-year follow-up of that study, those effects had completely disappeared, and now when they reran the cost-benefit analysis, the costs were $10,000 higher than the benefits. So it just suggests the need for a long-term evaluation. And this, again, is one of those cases where Job Corps was funding a lot of different programs. So there were probably some things in there that were working and some things that were not. But on average, there was not a big not effect at 7 years. Quantum Opportunity Program, this is just a youth development program that had an employment component. 9-year follow-up, no effect on employment. Growing America Through Entrepreneurship, the GATE program, provided training and assistance to individuals in how to start their own business. Found some initial effects over the first 6 months, 9 months after the program, but by the 5-year follow-up, there were no effects on earnings, employment, or the likelihood of owning a business. And then individual training accounts, these tested the relative effectiveness of 3 approaches to funding job training for unemployed adults. So in this study, everybody in the study got a job training account, but what varied was how much structure there was to that account, how much guidance they got from workforce staff in terms of the training that they were supposed to go into. And they did find some suggestive evidence that a more structured approach could increase earnings, but they only found that when they surveyed people about their earnings, but they didn't see the same effect when they looked at administrative data of earnings. So it's probably a case where another evaluation is needed to get the real answer. So now let me turn to the good news. The programs with strong evidence of sizable effects. And when I'm talking about strong evidence, I'm generally talking about large randomized trials with very long-term follow-ups and sizable effects on important outcomes. Career academies, which I mentioned earlier, so I won't go into detail again on that, although I will mention that the sample population for the Career Academy's evaluation was 50% Hispanic, which I know lines up fairly well with New Mexico's demographics. H&R Block College Financial Aid Application Assistance Program. I know we've talked a lot about maybe the pros and cons of going to college, but this is a program that was designed to decrease the barriers to going to college for low-income families, basically make it much easier for them to get financial aid. And so the way it worked was researchers teamed with H&R Block to develop an intervention in which families, when they came in to do their taxes at H&R Block, were offered the opportunity to, at the same time, fill out their financial aid form. This is a form that usually takes hours and hours to complete, especially if you're not familiar with what they're asking for. But it basically requires the same information that's required to fill out your taxes. And so this H&R Block intervention took what's usually a multiple-hour process and boiled it down to 15 minutes. And they filed the application for the families. And at a four-year follow-up, the researchers have found a 29% increase in college enrollment and college persistence among college-age students from those families. So we're still waiting for the graduation effects, probably one more year, and those will be out. Hopefully they'll be positive, too. But if they are, that would obviously be important for the workforce system. Now I'll close with a few promising programs. The distinction I'm making between promising and strong here is mostly the follow-up period. A lot of these programs were found to have effects after a couple of years. Ideally, you'd want to see a longer-term follow-up because of that Job Corps example I mentioned where sometimes things fade away. But some promising initial effects. The Unemployment Insurance Self-Employment Demonstration provided training and counseling on how to start a business. And so it's a lot like the GATE program that was found to have no real effects. But in this particular evaluation, in Massachusetts and Washington State, you saw some pretty good effects on earnings, likelihood of owning a business, time spent working. And so one suggestion that we would make is that if you're going to go the entrepreneurship training route in terms of workforce reform, you'd want to really focus in on what they were doing in Massachusetts and Washington State, since they got these pretty sizable effects, whereas they didn't find big effects in the GATE program. The Unemployment Job Search Assistance Demonstration, basically this just tested making it mandatory that long-term unemployment insurance recipients engage in a job search. And in Washington, D.C., it was found to produce a sizable effect on earnings and net savings to the government. In Florida, they found few significant effects, and it may be because the mandate was not vigorously enforced. So this is one of those cases where knowing about implementation is really important, because the program was to have this mandate, but if you don't enforce the mandate, then there's no real intervention that you're doing at all. So, and then the last promising program I'll mention is Perscolis, and this is a sectoral employment program in New York City. And so by a sectoral employment program, I mean a job training program in which the training provider worked closely with local employers to make sure that the training aligned with the workforce needs of the employers. In the specific case of Perscolis, Perscolis trained students to repair computers, and the goal was to get them to get an A-plus certification, which is recognized in the industry. And then once they've gotten that certification, Perscolis helps the program participants find a job. The program was evaluated in a large randomized trial, and in the second year after random assignment, found very large effects on earnings, $4,700 a year increase. I think all of us would take that in annual earnings and in time employed. And I should also mention that the same researchers that evaluated this sectoral employment program also evaluated two other sectoral employment programs in Wisconsin and Boston that were in different fields, healthcare, accounting, and they actually found similarly promising effects. They weren't quite as rock solid as the Perscolis one, but the fact that these researchers found three promising findings in three different programs using this general approach suggests that the sectoral employment model may be a promising approach. And so that's sort of what workforce rigorous evaluations have taught us in workforce policy. Okay. just a few concluding thoughts. The main one is really the first one. That faithfully scaling up workforce programs that are already backed by the strongest evidence often provides the best bet for improving workforce outcomes. Since, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of promising ideas turn out not to work when they're rigorously evaluated, if you have a program that has strong evidence, it probably increases your chances of success. Am I okay on time? Okay. Second one, for promising programs where you don't yet have strong evidence, so if there's some promising job training programs here in the state, you might want to look to some of those federal evidence-based initiatives that I mentioned earlier and that are in your packet, like the Workforce Innovation Fund, since one of the main goals of those programs is to evaluate these promising interventions and hopefully move them into the proven category over time. And then finally, just one thought for your consideration, is to maybe increase in-state capacity to conduct rigorous evaluations, particularly low-cost ones, so that you can expand the number of evidence-based programs that are available. So this could involve making sure that grad students in universities in the state are well-trained in carrying out these evaluations or at least interpreting them, making sure that state officials, there are at least some state officials who are well-versed in these types of evaluations. And then the final piece is just making sure that there's good administrative data that researchers can use to measure programs' effectiveness. So if you have good administrative data on earnings and employment, you can dramatically reduce the cost of doing these types of studies, because the most expensive part of any type of study, whether a randomized, comparison group, or pre-post, is tracking everybody down in your sample and surveying them or testing them. So if you already have all of the data on hand already, you can really bring the cost of those studies down to a fairly nominal amount. So with that, let me close. That's just my contact information, and I think we're ready for questions and answers.
Okay, thank you so much. Let's give him a big hand. Thank you.